because God transcends space and time, God is always ready to meet you in your moment, whatever it holds.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
So it's my great privilege to welcome Stephanie Duncan-Smith to The Profile today. Stephanie, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Would you just start off by telling us a little bit about your own faith journey? What is your own personal testimony?
It started young for me. I was raised by Christian parents in the U.S., in the state of Maryland. And I think, you know, two things really marked my childhood. One is two rhythms. One is the rhythm of spiritual practice, of going to church on Sundays and Sunday school, and kind of those rituals in the household of praying before meals and, you know, devotional readings as a family. And then the second was related, but really the ritual of just the daily dinner meal around the table in the evening. And well, I might add a third one too, which we'll probably talk more about later. But the third ritual was reading books. I come from a reading family, and that I think has always instilled in me a love for the word, in the specific and broad sense of the word made flesh in the incarnation, which has really been, I think, if I were to look back on my faith journey from childhood to adulthood to now and ongoing, it's my spiritual imagination has always been just animated and enlivened by the incarnation. And that's, yeah, there's a lot to that, but I think it started as a child and kind of being caught up in the stories of God and hearing about the stories of God with us and what that might look like for me, even as a kid, and giving that time to grow.
Can you remember a particular point when you actually accepted Jesus, or is it just something that's just always beautifully been there in the background of your life?
I don't remember that point. I know I was very young. I was 4 or 5. But I do remember, I have an early memory of just, you know, being outside. It was probably spring, a little bit of a windy day. And I was probably 4 or 5. I remember drawing on a piece of paper. And in my mind, this was sort of a love letter to God. It was a card that I wanted to send somehow. So I put it out on the table, at the outdoor table, and went inside for a little bit, hopeful that maybe it would fly away and find God. And I was just delighted that I came back and it was gone. And again, my young imagination was so enthralled with this being of love. And I felt that. And I remember that being impressed in different ways, but I felt it, you know, in my own play and prayer. I would say that was a practice of prayer as a very young child. And I remember feeling it in characters like Aslan in the Narnia series, where you just feel this immense magnetic pull of love toward you. And kids know that. Kids know it when they see it. And it was something that I knew as a kid.
I love that. I love that it was your imagination that was captured, and that element of storytelling has always been so present in your life, because that is now really what you do for a living in lots of different ways. Tell us about your career journey and what some of the things that you've done.
Yeah, so I work in publishing. I acquire and edit nonfiction titles for adults. And I've done that for, gosh, I think 16 years now. And The books, there's a lot of bookshelves in my house. There's too many, arguably.
I can see lots behind you.
I'm also married to a professor, which does not help our situation. So lots and lots of books in our house. I have always been a reader. I say I was a reader first. Always a reader first. I'm a writer by passion and an editor by profession. So I come at it from all angles, but I'm obsessed with a story well told. And, you know, people ask me, do you ever get, you know, do you like reading for pleasure? Like, do you, you work on books all day, you're swimming in words all day. Do you actually like reading for fun on your own? And the honest answer is I do. I really do. I can't get enough. I really can't. So, and the best thing about reading and, you know, editing work is that you don't get immune to that pull of the story. It never goes away. I came into publishing as a reader. I've always been a reader, and I've always been a writer that's taken different forms. As a kid, it was really poetry. It was my first form. And which is interesting because I don't really identify as a poet anymore. That's not a form that I'm drawn to like I was, but it certainly shaped me. Even in my writing of prose, I can feel that it still shapes me. And I've always been a journaler. So there's something about narrating the real time of your own personal narrative. And again, you know, I do think that there's a very, very rich spiritual practice of narrating how God is showing up in your life right now. And you don't have to be a quote unquote good or gifted writer to do that. That's something that's available to all of us. It's just noticing and witnessing. It's really an act of witness. So I came into publishing through the back door of publicity, actually. I was going to college and university, and there was a small press across the street, and one of my professors said, you should get an internship there. And I thought, oh, that's a great idea. Why didn't I think of that? So I applied for an internship. What they had open was one in the publicity department. So I took that, and it ended up being an excellent place to get my feet wet in the world of publishing, because in publicity, of course, the book is done and the job is really to represent the sharpest, most distilled version of that message to media that you possibly can. So you're looking for the hooks. You're looking for what's going to snap people to attention and say, oh my gosh, I need this book. I need it today. And that is such a great skill to bring into the editorial process on the front end. So I started in publicity, but now my work with authors is really distilling the essence at the outset and saying, okay, how can we structure this book to most effectively meet readers where they are? And how can we style this message into its boldest best at the beginning of the process?
Now, I feel like you've already touched on five or six different really interesting concepts that I'd love to talk to you more about, particularly this area of imagination and story, because it's something that I also really love the idea of. And this idea that children are kind of born with this, you know, innate curiosity and wonder about the world. And you've so beautifully expressed how you found God through that, you know, also being part of a Christian home helps. What do you think about how well the church stewards that gift more widely? Are we good at communicating to the wide world the wonder of the story of Jesus, and how do we do that well? Do we do it well?
Yeah, it depends. It depends who you're asking. I think we can always. I think that wonder is a very underestimated virtue of the Christian life. And I don't think I'm speaking in very blanket terms here. So, you know, there's always exceptions, but I don't think that we do it justice in the way that it deserves. And I think about this. I mean, my immediate frame for this is I have a 2 and a 4-year-old right now, and their imagination so vastly outpaces mine. I have so much to learn from them. And I have a sense, and again, I'm speaking in generalities here, but I think that grownups, we have this idea that we've somehow outgrown the powers of our imagination in daily life. And that's just not it for kids. Kids are so in touch with the life of play and possibility and wonder. And, you know, we not only kind of evolve past that naturally, but we also, I think, get into a rut where we start to believe, oh, that's childish, you know, that's below us. And I think there's so much to be gained in coming back to the wonder and of especially the sacred stories. And there's an amazing story that I think of, and this helps illustrate it. So I don't know if you're familiar with, or if people in the UK are even familiar with an author named Jerome Berryman. Does that ring any bells?
Not to me personally, but it might do to some of our listeners. I don't know.
Okay. So he is the founder of a children's spiritual curriculum called Godly Play. And it originated in the US. And it's pretty niche. I don't, you know, it's used many Episcopal settings in the US, but it's this incredible curriculum for kids, and it's all wonder-based, and that's why I'm bringing it up now. And there's an amazing story that I heard about Jerome, who, when he was teaching Godly Play to a group of kids, and they're all, you know, just fidgety kids sitting in a circle on the floor, and he starts to tell just one of the classic kids Sunday school Bible stories. And this little girl says, "I've heard this one before," kind of shutting it down, like, been there, done that, don't need it. And he said, "How old are you? When is your next birthday?" And she said, 6, I'm about to be 7. And he said, "Excellent. So you've already," and he asked her about, you know, birthday parties of yore, and she got really excited and told all about the party and the cake and the sprinkles. And he said, "Well, great, you've already had a birthday party, so you don't ever need to have one again." And she was like, oh. and kind of got the point. Look, there's always more to discover in the stories that you think you know. Just because you've had one birthday party doesn't mean that you're one and done and you can't enjoy that experience again. Just because you've heard this story and you think you know it doesn't mean that there aren't new layers and new dimensions that you can, that can generate that sense of wonder anew with every exposure to it. And I see that impulse in us a lot as Christians. It's like, oh no, I know that. I've been there, done that. And I think the invitation is, come take another look. You might be surprised. And I do think that God to me is just in the business of surprises, you know? And that's where the wonder comes in. It's like, oh wow, I wasn't expecting that. So prepare to be surprised. I think we could all do with a little more of that. And I think that's part of the adventure of faith.
Do you think that has anything to do with what we're seeing in the US and in the UK and in other parts of the world now around what we are sort of talking about as this Gen Z renewal or revival? Is it a turning back maybe from the sort of the predominance of atheism in the 80s and 90s to this sense of wonder and something more that is out there and young people are for some reason more open to exploring that right now?
Yeah, that's a big conversation. It's hard for me to say what is driving that. But I do think it's only human to look for something meaningful, and you know, that's there's a and hopefully people find it in the right place, you know. It's hard to say what people's motives are, and I think that's especially complicated in the US right now with our political environment and landscape. But I think that wonder can actually, I think there's a big contrast. There's like in the conversation of wonder, there's I'm being surprised by this and it wasn't what I expected, but I'm open to it. And then there's this other, the antithesis of that is this mindset that's kind of a foregone conclusion that's very dogma driven. And it's like, no, this is the way. Everything is black and white. It's this or that. It's us or them. And you can see how the difference there in posture when that's like, we're shutting this conversation down. We're not open to wonder. We're not open to being surprised. We already know. And then there's like, well, I'm going to be open and see what God might be up to. And I think that those, I that's a posture that I hope for all of us.
Definitely. So let's talk about your new book, Even After Everything, which I had the pleasure of reading earlier on this year. It's been out for a while now. Tell us a little bit about what it's about and why you decided to write it.
So I always tell my authors, one of the biggest pieces of advice I give prospective writers is write the book you can't not write. And speaking of surprise, I was surprised that I wrote this one, but it became for me the book that I couldn't not write. And it had to come out. And like many stories, this was born out of personal experience and a painful experience. It's called Even After Everything. And the subtitle is The Spiritual Practice of Knowing the Risks and Loving Anyway. And it was born for me out of this clash of kind of hoping for the best and fearing the worst and trying to find some solid ground and some steadiness in the thick of that tension. And I think, you know, whatever the particularities of your experience, and it can look very different from person to person, but we all know what it's like to feel this intensity of love and also feel this intensity of fear that the worst is going to happen to that person that we love or those people that we love. And it's so hard. And I don't really hear people talk about risk as in the spiritual life. So I was very curious to explore that and excavate and uncover, okay, when we're in that decision of, do I take this risk or do I play it safe? What does God want to say to us? And what are the promises that we can stand on? And also I want to strip away the false promises that we can't stand on, because I think that there's a lot of people who put words in God's mouth that God never says. And I mean, the biggest example is just the promise of a safe and secure outcome. It's not a promise that we have. So what do we have? So I wrote to discover that. And for me, it started. So my husband and I were childless by choice for almost a decade. We were living life. We were happy, and but we did want to try for a family. So when the time came, I learned I was pregnant, and I was approaching Advent and kind of walking through Advent with this first pregnancy, and it was really, really beautiful, meaningful, rich experience until I lost that pregnancy. And it was the week before Christmas. It was Advent's week of joy. And that felt just like salt in the wound. And it felt like the whole world was readying to celebrate this ultimate verse story, but not for me. I was shut out of that narrative. That's what it felt like. And it was astonishingly painful. It's the first time in my entire life I did not go to the Christmas Eve service because I just didn't think I could emotionally handle it. And so that's where it started.
Hi, it's Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity magazine. I'm proud to say we are celebrating our 60th anniversary. From our beginnings as Buzz in the 1960s to the vibrant multi-platform magazine we are today, our commitment to connecting faith with the world around us has never changed. To mark the occasion, we have a special offer of 12 months for half price. That's just £24 for print and digital access. Subscribe today at premierchristianity.com. Automatically renews at £47.99.
Fast forward to 1 year later, literally one calendar year later, it's Advent and I am giving birth to my daughter in the hospital, and it's, you know, everybody's safe, everybody's good. And in that circle of a year, from Advent to Advent, from loss to new life, there was so much uncertainty and risk, and the fear of trying again, the fear of hoping again. There were multiple physical and medical scares along the way. And not to mention, this was all during the global pandemic. So we were already terrified in our homes of just risk all around us. And that's where I really had to find that those practices of steadiness that were able to hold me up. And ultimately, I found it in really just the promise of God with us. And, you know, I didn't know where the story would end. I did not know how this was going to go, but I knew that God was with me and cared, and that I could stand on. And that was able to give me that solid ground to continue on.
Hmm. And you told me earlier that you grew up in a Christian home. You've always been a Christian. You said there that it was the first time you'd ever not been to the Advent like church service at your church because you just couldn't face it, which I think everybody would be totally sympathetic towards. Is it hard or harder in some expressions of Christianity to deal with those moments of pain than in others? And how did you negotiate working your way through that and coming to grips with aspects of things that you'd previously found very joyous, which were suddenly very painful?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It was like a whiplash. It felt like a whiplash experience of, and in that, if I'm very honest, it felt like a betrayal. It felt like I'd been tricked, that, you know, I had just moved through these really, really meaningful, I mean, my life was in parallel with the liturgical story in a way that was like, wow, really awe-inspiring. And then it just wasn't. And there was a break that happened, and it felt like a betrayal. And I had to reckon through that. And what ultimately helped me is that I realized that the story of Advent and Christmas is the story of God coming to be with us, but it's the story of God coming to be with us because we are a people in pain. If you don't mind, I'm going to read one piece where I discover this. And I had to work through to get to this perspective, but it helped me. So I write, the first language of this expectant season of Advent is not bell carols, but groaning, the audio ache of a hurting world. The God of Advent is not a God of indifference, but the God who imagined mere neurons into existence, the cell network responsible for so much of what makes us human, which is the basic ability to read and respond to the emotional needs of others. Every human encounter of empathy begins with mirror neurons firing in witness to pain. It is fitting then that the sacred year begins with Advent. Human pain is the call, every nerve ending crying out. The incarnation is the response. God hears the crashing cries of our great fall, and like a mother, comes running. Emmanuel rushes through time and space to be not just near our hurt, but human with us in it. What I had missed was the very essence of Advent. This is an entire season dedicated to hearing the hurt and naming the night. We are not just allowed to do so, we are openly called to do so. I just needed to discover this for myself.
That's very beautiful and very profound, and not something that I've heard expressed very often within a Christian context, which I guess goes back to your point of why you felt that you needed to write this book. Is it something that we need to get better at acknowledging, particularly within celebration seasons in the church?
Yes, I hope so. I hope so. And part of why, so I structured the book, as I said, the book moves from Advent to Advent, a circle of the year. But through that year, actually, each chapter is based in a liturgical season. So we're moving through Advent, through Christmas, through Epiphany, through Lent and Easter and Ordinary Time. And each season has a different theme. It has a different invitation. And what really fascinated me as I delved into this, and I do find my home personally in the liturgical tradition. So I love these seasons. They're incredibly rich metaphors for me. But even if that's not your tradition, or you have no history with, you don't know what Epiphany means, that's fine. You don't have to. But I think the point and the purpose of moving through the seasons is God really has a time for everything. And even if you are not feeling like I did not that Christmas, if you are not feeling joy to the world in one moment, that's okay. Because elsewhere in the story, there is rich remembrance of loss and grief and pain. And there really is a time for everything. And because God transcends space and time, God is always ready to meet you in your moment, whatever it holds. And I think it can be really hard, just like it was absolutely wrenching for me to feel, I felt very unseen by the joy of the Christmas season because I was not feeling joy. And so I felt very unseen. And what I had to discover for myself is, you know, you don't have to invalidate someone else's joy to feel your own pain. And that's just as valid. And the reverse is also true. You know, if your joy is real and authentic, you don't have to downplay that for someone else's grief. You can recognize that that's theirs and this is yours. And you don't have to do all this complicated math to cancel one out, because I think the sacred year is a story that's big enough to hold all of it. And that was really freeing for me. And even in the Advent story, even there, you know, we tend to think it's the celebratory, you know, high season, and it is. But the Gospels also give us a very, very dark underbelly of a story of King Herod's jealousy and the lengths that he took to try and wipe out this new child king. And it was a real gift and a turning point for me when I revisited those stories that are not often in the nativity, right? But it was a real, real eye-opening event for me when I took another look and I found, you know, this is, there are mothers who lost their children just as Jesus was born. And not only do the Gospels, they tell that story, they don't omit it, they don't take it out, but also God witnesses those grieving mothers and those families and those children by bringing in a prophecy from from the Old Testament and calling upon Rachel weeping for her children. So just as I was feeling so unseen by the joy of this season, I realized, actually, that's not true. I am radically seen in this narrative of a grieving mother who's lost, and that weeping is heard by God. So I think we have to be careful as you know, it's a human impulse, and there's a Christianized version of the impulse to kind of make it all better really quickly. And I don't think that's the way that God moves. I think that God is present with us in the utmost of those hard emotions and isn't quick to say, oh, just get over here where it gets a little better. He's just sitting with us for as much time as we need, and we're seen in whatever we're feeling and going through.
How did you and your husband work through the pain of that time together? Did it look different for both of you?
Yeah, it looked different. And we also did a lot of grieving together. I think that we made a commitment early on that we weren't going to, it felt really painful to sort of pretend that everything was fine. So we made a commitment not to do that. And that was with our families, with our friends. We did what we needed to take care of ourselves. And sometimes that was telling people, this is what I need today. Like, I don't want to talk about it. Or, okay, now I want to talk about it. Okay, now I'm done. You know? And we also had to learn later on how to hope again together. And it was a lot easier with each other's support. Something that interested me as I was writing this book is just kind of the research showing that when you have secure relationships, it actually enables you to take greater risks in life, which makes sense. My husband, Zach, has always been my home base of safety. And, you know, being that for each other could help us be brave toward a future where we hoped for a healthy pregnancy. And, but we needed each other for that. Mm. It was a team effort.
And I mean, obviously we can work the timelines back, so we can know how long it took you before you felt ready to take that leap of hoping again for something different. But in terms of, like, was it a conscious decision? Did you sit down and talk about it? Did you say, okay, right, now I feel like I'm ready to process this again? And how did you get past that sense of what you described earlier as like almost feeling betrayed by God in terms of being pregnant and then losing it?
I really had to do the deep work of wrestling through that. And I also think that, you know, I don't for a second think that God is put off by our honesty. And the only way that I could work through to trust again was through being brutally honest with God and myself, and giving myself space to do that instead of, again, doing that cleanup work of kind of the surface polish and pretending that it's all fine. I just didn't have it in me to do that. And I had to keep it honest. It was the only way I could work it through. I appreciate the question. For, you know, honestly, the reasoning for I was able to get pregnant again relatively quickly. It was a decision that we made together to try again. And the calculus was honestly the realization that we did want kids. And at that point, it was interesting because I probably came into the parenthood journey a little bit ambivalent. I sort of cognitively knew that we wanted kids, but I wasn't emotionally invested in a way that it seemed to me many women were at that stage. And after the loss, that changed completely. I was all in, emotionally invested. I wanted this more than I'd ever wanted anything. And it really transformed me. And I knew just pragmatically that if this is what we wanted, we would have to take the risk again. And it was going to be hard, whether it was now or 6 months from now or a year from now, it was going to be hard no matter when it happened. So, you know, I think we recognized that and thought, if it's going to be hard, then let's just get on with it. And I think, you know, I want to add to this, that this theme of that decision moment of taking a risk that terrifies you, we all have to do that in life in different contexts. And something that has really been illuminated to me through living this message, writing this book, and, you know, practicing it is that I think that ultimately when we take the risk in the name of love, we end up really becoming proud of who we are no matter what happens, because we become the kind of people who do the hard thing in the name of love no matter what happens. And I think it's also really important to add that in the sensitive, you know, experiences of trying to conceive and pregnancy and loss, I actually endured a second loss while I was editing this book. Mm-hmm. And went on to have my son after that. But it was this experience of deja vu. You know, I had people in my life asking me, you know, my mom, my husband, my agent were kind of trying to gently find ways to ask me, does this experience, I mean, your worst nightmare just happened to you again after you did all this work, this inner work, you know, does it change how you want to write your book, or does it change the message? And it was a really powerful experience for me to consider that question and honestly say it doesn't change anything. Because what I can stand on is that promise of God with me no matter what. And no, it was a very kind of unexpectedly validating experience to realize, oh, I actually have been honest with myself. There's no illusions or pretenses that need to be stripped away from this, even after the second time. That meant something to me. And again, I think, you know, that's what taking risks does. It you learn how to weather them a little bit better, and you what you don't lose is that presence of God with you through it all.
What would you say to someone who has been through an experience like yours, or a loss of some kind, who feels that they're not able to take that risk and love again, or choose to try to hope? Is there ever a time when it's okay just to say that hurt too much? I don't want to risk going there.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And I'm so glad that you asked that, because taking risks doesn't mean you have to be reckless. And I think self-preservation is a very, you know, noble pursuit. So only you can discern that with God. That's between you and God to discern. And yeah, I mean, everyone gets to decide that for themselves. I do think that I remember there was a moment with this would have been my fourth pregnancy. So my pregnancy with my son, it was my first ultrasound with him. And I've been in that chair so many times. I've been in that moment so many times. And, you know, the Doppler is showing the Doppler was showing the image before we had the sound to the Doppler, if that makes sense. And I just had this moment and I looked at that image and I looked at my son and I felt the surge of love. And I didn't know if there was a heartbeat yet, but I felt the surge of love. And I just thought, I can't take that back. You know, whether there's a heartbeat or not, this love, I will not take it back. And no one can take that from me, no matter what happens. And I think, you know, my kids, we just had a new sitter who watched them, and they were very nervous, 2 and 4. And we were just kind of talking about what to do when you feel nervous and how to be brave. And what I landed on with them was, remember all the people who love you. And we listed out, you know, all the people who love them and God and Jesus. And I said, remember all that love and let that love help you feel brave. And preaching to myself, you know, I mean, I hope that when we remember who loves us and how loved we are, it can help us be brave when we need to. And I think, you know, yeah, we can also discern when it's the time not to be brave and when it's the time to say, I gotta take care of myself. I can't put myself through that. And that takes courage too. That takes just as much courage too.
Now, I am from a part of the church that doesn't do the liturgical calendar very well. It's not been a prominent part of my faith journey at all. So I actually found it super interesting reading your book and learning more about even things like ordinary time, which I'm ashamed to admit I've never even heard of before. And also really interested to hear how you were talking about the way that the cyclical nature of life actually intersects with our Christian faith, and particularly as women, and talking about monthly cycles and all of those things. And I've genuinely never heard or read anything teasing those issues apart in a Christian context. And I found it super interesting. Would you just talk to us a little bit more about that and why you decided to sort of begin to unpack that?
Yeah, thank you. And also no shame in not knowing any of the liturgical rhythms. You know, if you're into it, you're into it. And if you're not, that's fine. You know, there's different expressions and this is not the only one. I think what I'm so fascinated by seasonal and cyclical patterns. And I think if I'm zooming out, I mean, there's so many different expressions of those and you just named a few. There's the natural seasons, there's the cycle of the liturgical year, there's the cycle of women's bodies in you know, the reproductive cycle. There's so many different frames for it. But if I'm zooming out as far as I possibly can to talk about kind of the vision of the cycles and that perspective, what really rises up for me is the pattern, and I think it's the sacred pattern of life and death and resurrection. And what's interesting to me about that is that pattern, life and death and resurrection, I think it's recognizable to all of us universally, even if someone's not a person of faith. We recognize those rhythms. And I think there's also a real, real wisdom and hope embedded in the Christian cycle of the year, because embedded in that cycle is the promise that resurrection is the end of the story. And, you know, we might go through our cycles of death and loss, but resurrection will always have the last word. And also there's another hope too, and for all of us facing different circumstances, but the other hope is that the cycle of the church year, I mean, it would feel weird, right? It would feel weird if I had my Christmas tree up in July. That would not feel right. There's a time and place for that. It's not July. again, everything in its place, everything in its time. And I think there's a real hope for us in the cycling of the liturgical seasons to say, you're actually not supposed to get stuck anywhere. Even in Christmas, the cycles, the seasons keep moving. And I think the hope is if they can keep moving, so can we. You know, life ebbs and flows. It is not static. It is in fluid motion all the time. And, you know, there's something for all of us. I'll read just a quick excerpt here to express that. But life is like this, a great shimmering color wheel of emotions that jostle against each other in surprising, sometimes unsettling ways. Time holds many memories, and anniversaries overlap and overlay the present. Life, death, and resurrection cycle through our days. We weave in and out of bouts of brimming over joy, impossible hope, and fragile fear. Life is absurd because so much happens and so little makes sense. And it is exquisite because even as the kaleidoscope turns, look at all that color. And I think just getting at that concept of juxtaposition, we all live in, life is nothing if not juxtaposition. It's sorrow against joy, against fear, against delight. It's everything all at once. And we have to find our practices of living through that and finding that solid ground. And I think that the turning of the liturgical year says to me two things. It says, one, you're not doing it wrong. You're not crazy. If you're feeling that tension, if your personal moment is not lining up with the moment of the season, you're not doing it wrong. And second, God is ever present with you. And as I write in the book, God has made a covenant of constancy with us. While everything around us might feel all over the place, God is ever present and seeing you in your personal moment and powerfully with you. And there's a wonderful writer, Wendy Wright, who I quote in the book. She's written a lot of liturgical books, and she talks about how we are radically accompanied by God. And I just love that.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thought, isn't it? That God's accompaniment, sometimes we think of him being very soft and gentle, and sometimes it's not quite that in the harshness of whatever maelstrom that we're facing.
Right.
If you could name it, what would be the one way that your faith has changed as a result of the experiences that you've been through in the last few years?
I think it has really, I've always had a little bit of an anaphylactic reaction to spiritual over promising, if that makes sense. The sort of everything happens for a reason and greener pastures ahead. I just, that's not always true. And I can't pretend that it is. So I've always had that bent, but I think living through this has given me greater reserves of resilience to say, because I am accompanied, I can get through a lot more than I think I can. And also, you know, I talked about the personal experience of feeling betrayed by this loss. And it felt so deep and personal and gutting. And I had to deal with a lot of anger. I think that was, if I had to give it a name, it was anger. It was, how dare you do this to me? And, you know, I had to work through, first of all, I don't believe that God did this to me. I don't think God works that way. This is just, it's something that happened and God was with me through it. So I had to work through that. And also, I think one way my faith has also really been changed is my love for my kids has given me such a fresh view for God's love for me. And I write about this in the book, but it fascinated and floored me to learn that the Hebrew roots of the word mercy, the translation is actually womb love. And, you know, the Old Testament speaks so much about God's loving kindness. That's the word that mercy, it's translated as, you know, mercy, loving kindness. It's womb love. And I just thought, I understand a lot more of what that means now than I would have previously. Just that aching, just the aching for someone you love to be well and to live and to live well. Mm-hmm. And that knowing that that is God's stance toward all of us in kind of a never abandoning, never wavering kind of love stays with me. And it supports me when especially things feel shaky.
And do you still feel that same level of wonder that 6-year-old Stephanie felt? You know, I think there's this kind of perception or perhaps assumption that when we, you know, we're optimistic and hopeful and creative and imaginative in that way when we're young because we haven't experienced any of the hardships of life. And then when we go through hard stuff, that all of that optimism will somehow be sort of chipped away and or it becomes harder to hang on to it somehow because we've been through hard stuff. Do you feel that like that has changed for you or not?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And actually, so much of my book, I really work toward trying to express some of that wonder of the life of faith, of our bodies, of, you know, Advent and the story of God with us. That's what I get the most reader responses about is just, you know, the wow. And it's not me, it's the wow to the inherent incredible abilities of the human soul and body to, you know, to know God and to create new life and to move through difficult things. There's many different points to that in the book, but I think I've become almost, I'm searching for the right word. I'm very on the search for more of that. I kind of just want more and more. It's like I got a taste and I can't get enough now. And I'm, you know, it's October now as we're having this conversation, but my mind is already in Advent because I can't get enough. And I just want to experience that awe and that hush of wow as I sit and immerse and steep in this story. So yeah, I think it's a practice to stay alive and awake to it, but the more I taste, the more I want.
Amen. Thank you so much, Stephanie.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Mercy Ships is transforming lives across Africa through medical training and free surgery. Joining me is Dr. Manjeet Dhillon, a volunteer surgeon. Dr. Manjeet, for anyone who doesn't know, what does Mercy Ships actually do?
Mercy Ships is a faith-based charity who deploy hospital ships to some of the poorest parts of the world. And our hospital ship will dock for several months in places where people simply can't access safe surgery. On board, we have everything you would find in a modern hospital. Patients are offered world-class surgery completely free of charge, and at the same time, we train local doctors and nurses so they can keep providing care after we're gone.
You must have met so many people whose lives have been changed. Are there any that stayed with you?
On a recent visit to Madagascar, I met 2-year-old Armella. She was born with a grapefruit-sized tumour behind her ear. Her mum prayed every day that someone would help her. And when our ship arrived, myself and other medical and nursing volunteers from around the world removed the tumour free of charge. Now Armella is healthy, happy and full of life.
And how can listeners help more people like Armella?
Right now, every gift is being matched pound for pound up to 400,000. Your generosity could help a child get the surgery they've been waiting for or help train a nurse or doctor to change lives for years to come.
Thank you, Dr. Manjeet.
If you'd like to help transform more lives like Armella's, visit mercyships.org.uk/premier.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.